Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Well, in just a few minutes, we're going to talk about Trump's aggressive assault on the judiciary and how his administration has been repeatedly defying court orders. Chris Geidner of Law Dork is going to join us in just about 10 minutes. We were also going to discuss Trump's first 100 days in office and how it's been affecting children in particular. Unfortunately, our guest at the last minute couldn't make it, so we've got about 10 minutes here, and we would love to invite listener calls and listener thoughts about how the Trump administration's first 100 days have gone, in your opinion. Have you been affected by the Trump administration policies? Do you have thoughts or ideas about what the opposition party could be doing in response to Trump's first 100 days? The number to call to join this conversation, and like I said, we've got the phone lines open for the next 10 minutes or so until we can start our segment on Trump's judicial setbacks and his war on the judiciary. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with any questions or comments at yourcall@kalw.org. Again, we'll be talking about how the Trump administration is faring in court. We have Chris Geidner, who will be joining us shortly. He's really an expert and an incredible unrelenting reporter in terms of covering all of what's happening in the judiciary. If anyone is following Chris Geidner on social media, and if not, I recommend that you do, you will see that he is basically, it seems to me, almost pulling all-nighters trying to cover what's happening. But like I say, in the meantime, we do have a few minutes here since our guest has canceled and would love to hear from you, your thoughts about how the first 100 days of the Trump administration are going. That number, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So we would love to hear from you. And in the meantime, we do hope that we can get our guest, Eli Hager from ProPublica, back on at a future date to talk about the impact of Trump's first 100 days on child services in particular. And I can just quote, just so you have a sense of what Eli was going to be discussing on the program. This is from his ProPublica piece about the cutbacks. And he writes, "The staff of a program that helps millions of poor families keep the electricity on, in part so that babies don't die from extreme heat or cold, have all been fired. The federal office that oversees the enforcement of child support payments has been hollowed out. Head Start preschools, which teach toddlers their ABCs and feed them healthy meals, will likely be forced to shut down en masse, some as soon as May 1st, and funding for investigating child sexual abuse and internet crimes against children, responding to reports of missing children, and preventing youth violence has been withdrawn indefinitely." That's from the ProPublica article about Trump cutbacks to services that affect children. This is one of those issues that doesn't get as much attention when we think about Trump's first 100 days in office. Of course, there have been a lot of headlines, and rightly so, about deportations, about the federal cutbacks in spending from DOGE writ large, other court cases, defying court orders, which we're going to talk about. But this impact to children in particular has not gotten as much attention. And that's why we do want to open the phone lines before our segment on the judiciary writ large begins. And the number to call to join the conversation again is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners, your personal stories or questions. How have the first 100 days affected you? What cutbacks, what changes have you been experiencing in your life, in your career? What are your thoughts about what opposition members of the Congress, of the federal government, the state government could be doing in response to the policies we've seen in the first 100 days? So let's go to the phone lines now. We have William in Belvedere calling in. William, welcome to Your Call.
Very much. I think in a strange sense, it's fortunate that Trump has done all of this at once because it draws the issues so clearly. Had he stretched it out over time, it would not have been as apparent what he was doing. Thank you.
Thank you, William. I appreciate the thought that it's basically a sort of a blitzkrieg. Perhaps a Nazi analogy may not be too far off, although I say that hopefully in jest. But definitely all, the full suite of policy efforts are on the table and in the court system. And I think that's what we're going to talk about when Chris Geidner is able to join us, just exactly what's happening in the court system. I appreciate that call, that comment, and reflection. Again, the number is 866-798-TALK. We have Adam dialing in. Adam, welcome to your call. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. You know, I lived in this beautiful area for 61 years. I have never, ever, ever expected to see this beautiful country, this beautiful place to be destroyed by one single man who is surrounded by a bunch of demons. It is unreal. We need more education. We need more health care. Social Security, by the way, they're trying to steal it, is paid by the American people from the first day they work to the day they retire or die. These are a bunch of robbers and criminals. How do we stop them?
No. I mispronounced your name, too. It's Eid, I believe, is your name. And I'm sorry for
it's Adam.
Oh, Adam. Okay, good. Glad I have you. I guess Eid is coming up next. I'm sorry, miscommunication there. Adam, thank you for your comment. I think a lot of people feel the same. This has really been an unprecedented attack on our legal system, on constitutional provisions, and all of this is now being challenged in the court system. It's really, in many ways, the last guardrail against these moves. And so I do encourage listeners to stick around for Chris Geidner coming in a bit. Let's go to Fran in San Francisco. Fran, what are your thoughts about these first 100 days? Do we have Fran? All right, I don't think we have Fran. All right, hold on 1 second. We'll get Fran on the line. Do we have Fran?
Hello?
All right, there you are. Good to hear from you, Fran. Welcome
Hi.
To your call. Thank you for dialing in.
Good morning. Thank you for the show. In a summation of 25 words or less, I am 77 years old. I've always taken democracy for granted, as has my generation and the people in it. And the threats to it are very consuming for all of us. And we just hope that we'll get some answers, at least from the legal system, that will help. And I thank you all for doing the show.
Thank you, Fran. I so appreciate you dialing in, sharing those fears and concerns. And, you know, I work at UC Berkeley Law School for my full-time job on environmental law policy. And our dean, Erwin Chemerinsky, had an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times talking about when he teaches his constitutional law course, he presents students with both the Constitution to the United States government and the Constitution to the Soviet Union. And he notes that they actually read, because the Constitution for the Soviet Union, of course, is no longer in effect, but they actually read quite similar. And the Soviet Union, in some ways, enshrines more rights. But he says the difference between those two constitutions is that in the United States, we had judicial enforcement of those rights. And in the Soviet Union, there was no enforcement of those rights. So it was essentially a meaningless document. And I think that really tees up our segment on the judiciary and how important it is. If we don't have the judiciary to enforce our rights, our individual liberties and freedoms, then we essentially have a dead letter of a constitution. So I appreciate your comment there about how much we take this for granted. And we have Ruth dialing in from Berkeley. Ruth, welcome to your call.
Thank you. This is about six sentences long, and I'm 88. And I remember the McCarthy era. Donald Trump, you are a perfect storm of destruction. You are a manipulator of hate and fear. Your vengeful contempt is ruining our beloved country. You deserve a citizen's arrest. The buck should stop with you. With respect and concern for our country, Ruth Basu.
Thank you, Ruth, for sharing that sentiment. I feel that a number of listeners would definitely agree with you. The number to call to join the conversation, to share your thoughts, your experiences about how the first 100 days have been going for you, it's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We really appreciate hearing your calls as we have a last-minute opening in our show here ahead of our guest, Chris Geidner, who will be giving us the rundown on what's happening, the latest on the cases that are winding their way through the courts, setting up what is very much likely to be a showdown between the Supreme Court, the judicial branch, essentially, and the executive branch. I appreciate everybody calling in, and it sounds like we have Chris on the line, and I am going to introduce this segment now first by letting everybody know that we really just have one branch left of government as a guardrail on illegal and unconstitutional actions. Since January, Trump has ramped up his attacks on judges and defied the court in numerous cases. Most prominently, and perhaps most disturbingly, just last week, Judge Hannah Dugan, a sitting Wisconsin judge, was arrested by the FBI, charged with obstructing the arrest of an undocumented immigrant. This is the first known instance of the Trump administration charging a local official with interfering with immigration enforcement. Trump has also defied the Supreme Court's order to to facilitate the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia from an El Salvador prison. To get the latest on this, we are so pleased to be joined by Chris Kidner. He's a journalist and MSNBC columnist whose Law Dork newsletter covers the Supreme Court, law, and politics. He also contributes to Grid and Bolts and previously worked as a Supreme Court correspondent and legal editor at BuzzFeed News. As I mentioned at the outset, he must be pulling all-nighters. He is covering so many cases in so much depth. He is really the go-to source for everything that is happening right now in the judiciary. So, Chris, it is wonderful to have you on this program. Thank you so much for joining us.
So glad to be back.
So, Chris, we were just talking with listeners as we had some open time here on the air about the first 100 days. And I wanted to start by asking you, how do you assess these first 100 days in terms of what's been happening with the judiciary and this aggressive assault on the judiciary?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't catch what you had said, so I might end up repeating some of it, but it certainly has been disturbing. It has been a multi-pronged attack on not only courts and the judiciary, but also on the lawyers themselves who are bringing some of these cases and who had been involved in cases that Donald Trump had decided that he didn't like in the past. And that is extremely concerning, I think, along with that, and you had sort of been hinting out it at, if you hadn't outright said, we also essentially do not have any pushback from the legislative branch, which I think would be the element of the first 100 days that might be most surprising to the founders, that there's essentially been a complete abdication of responsibility from the legislative branch, not only when it comes to questions about like oversight and pushback and sort of more affirmative actions that you might think of Congress taking against a president, but also just standing up for their own their own responsibilities, their own sphere of influence when it comes to these funding questions about impoundment is the word that you've heard over the first 100 days, which is essentially this question of whether the president can decide just not to spend money that Congress appropriated for specific reasons. And he can't. That's not allowed. Mm-hmm. And yet you would normally think that would be at the least an area where Congress would push back and say, hey, no, we passed a budget, it was signed into law, and you have to do it. But even on that front, they haven't pushed back against Trump's actions. And so that sort of left us, as you said, with one branch, with the judicial branch to deal with cases challenging impoundment, not to mention everything else that Trump has done in the first 100 days.
It's such a really accurate analysis. I don't think the framers of the Constitution really envisioned partisan politics to the point where the legislative branch, as you said, is essentially not standing up for its own prerogative and its own powers. And now the battle has moved on to the judiciary. And that's why we're so pleased to have you joining us. And if you're just tuning in, this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind. I'm getting over a cold, so I have been coughing and had a little bit of a hoarse voice. So I apologize to listeners for that, but I am getting better. And I'm very pleased to be joined now by Chris Geidner, journalist and MSNBC columnist, whose Law Dork newsletter covers the Supreme Court law and politics. And Chris, there are so many cases that we could talk about, so many issues. And maybe let's start with perhaps in some ways one of the most shocking, which was this arrest of this Wisconsin judge, Hannah Dugan, for allegedly helping an undocumented immigrant evade arrest. Can you talk about that case, what the status is, and what the implications are of the federal government arresting a state judge?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that this is certainly concerning. There are real questions about whether or not, as this case, as they take this case to a grand jury, as they decide what charges they're going to go on that front, as they try to push this forward, what charges they can actually even allege, let alone get a jury to convict on. But as some people noted when this came out, there had been a similar case that had been filed against a judge in Massachusetts back during the first Trump administration. And I think that the biggest concern that I have about the arrest was that it felt to me, looking at what AG Bondi and Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, who, if you don't recall, used to be Trump's personal criminal defense lawyer before taking up the number two position in the Department of Justice, that they have made it clear that they, along with Trump, obviously, want to send a message to sanctuary jurisdictions that they're going to go after them. And I truly believe this was paired with an arrest of a former judge in the Southwest. I forget if it was New Mexico or Arizona. And I really felt, looking at it, once we got like the formal press release from the Justice Department, that this was essentially something that if Trump didn't order it, that they had decided they needed to do and get an arrest on this front out the door before the 100 days, that they wanted to send this message. And so they just did so. And I think when it comes to the Wisconsin case in particular, it seems like they leaned in a little further than they're going to be able to actually prove in court, because it essentially came down to this question of whether directing someone in the courtroom, allegedly, if these statements put in the FBI affidavit even turn out to be true, allegedly pointing this guy to go down the jury hallway before trying to leave the courtroom, whether or not that constitutes the necessary criminal function as set forward in the law that they had charged her with violating in the complaint. But I think it's much more dangerous for the message it's trying to send. It's trying to scare people into believing that even having a sanctuary jurisdiction is quote unquote illegal in and of itself, and that's obviously not true. And I think that that is the message that they want to send, so that they are willing to do a high profile arrest right before the 100 days in order to get headlines.
So it is a shocking development. I didn't realize that about the arrest of the retired judge as well. So it sounds like a fairly weak legal case, but very high in symbolic value and chilling effect on other judges potentially. But Chris, let me pivot and ask you about a decision that just came out. I believe it was yesterday, where a Trump appointed federal judge in Texas ruled that the administration had unlawfully invoked the Alien Enemies Act, and it blocked the administration from quickly deporting some alleged members of a Venezuelan gang. The judge is U.S. District Judge Fernando Rodriguez of the Southern District of Texas, who said that Trump had unlawfully invoked this 18th century wartime authority to speed up deportations. Can you talk about the significance of that case and what exactly this judge ruled and what the next steps might be?
Yeah, this was a really important decision on again, both on the message it sends and on the law in this case. The message it sends, as you said, I think it is very important that this was a judge. This is a Texas judge who was appointed by Trump in his first term. And what he did was issued the first permanent final ruling on whether or not Trump's Alien Enemies Act proclamation that he signed in secret on March 14th, that we all found out about on March 15th, whether that was legal. And what he concluded was what many of us thought on March 15th, no, it's not, because this is a wartime power, and the references to an invasion or a predatory incursion in the Alien Enemies Act, in addition to explicit war, refer to warlike activity. And what this judge did, this wasn't some broad activist judge opinion. This was a judge who sat there and said he went through the history. He looked at the way that the people challenging this proclamation were saying it should be interpreted. He looked at how the government said it should be interpreted, and he even looked through some of the historical documents himself. And what he essentially concluded was that all that the Trump administration had going for it was two dictionary definitions that sort of suggested it could be a broader definition than just war. But everything else, he said, pointed in the direction that this is a, if not explicitly only a wartime power, a warlike power, that invasion really means an organized effort to invade the country. And that's not what Trump alleged here. And so therefore, it essentially, this cannot be, the Alien Enemies Act cannot be used in this way.
And this is really the foundation of how Trump has been able to deport people to El Salvador, right? I mean, this is really attacking the foundation of these disappearances that we've seen of people who are deported.
The first two flights, this is not about Kilmar Abrego Garcia. Okay. And actually, this is really important, because Judge Rodriguez talked about this as well, that like Trump still has the Immigration and Nationality Act. He still has the INA, which gives the president, the executive branch, pretty strong powers on immigration, on removal, on deportations. Essentially, this is very similar to even the way that the the Supreme Court talked about the Alien Enemies Act. We're not questioning that you have strong powers. You just need to use them right. Mm-hmm. And in this case, and what was important here and what was different than what we've seen thus far in other rulings is this was a final judgment looking at the actual Alien Enemies Act and concluding that the way that Trump is using it is not permitted. And yeah. So as such, now this is a habeas case, and this came out of when the Supreme Court took up that original Alien Enemies Act case, and they decided 5-4 that you could only challenge the Alien Enemies Act with habeas cases. And what judges who have heard these petitions have universally said is we're only allowed to, even to the extent that you bring it as a class action, we're only allowed to create a class that affects our jurisdiction. So yesterday's ruling stops all of Alien Enemies Act proclamation related removals and transfers, which is important. So you can't just move them to another district from the Southern District of Texas, which is where the El Val Detention Center that was where the flights had left on March 15th are from. And he said, you can't do that.
Yeah. So we have so much more to cover, Chris, and we're really just scratching the surface. I do want to ask you about Kilmer Abrego Garcia's case and just the general state of the judiciary right after this short break. I also want to let listeners know you can get your questions and comments ready for Chris at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this short break with more from Chris Geidner, journalist and MSNBC columnist with the Law Dork newsletter. So stay with us after this short break. Welcome back. If you're joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show, and you can find out more information at our website on the KALW.org page. And if you have a show idea for us, guests you'd like us to have on, you can drop us a line at yourcall@KALW.org and call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. On today's show, we're talking about Trump's assault and war on the judiciary, how his legal cases are going in the judicial branch, and what the latest is on all of these cases that are winding their way. Eventually, we're going to likely see a Supreme Court showdown, and that's what we're going to talk to our guest about. We're joined by Chris Geidner, journalist, MSNBC columnist with the Law Dork newsletter. Chris covers the Supreme Court, law, and politics. You should follow him on social media if you don't already, if you're interested in what's happening in the judiciary. And we also want to hear from you if you have questions about some of these legal cases, if you have concerns about how the judicial branch is serving as a guardrail or not, and given the politics of the moment and the Trump administration assaults on all sorts of aspects of our federal government. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And Chris, we were just talking about the setbacks the administration had on their immigration crackdown and their flights of undocumented immigrants to foreign countries, namely El Salvador. And you were mentioning Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the man who was incorrectly deported to an El Salvador prison, and the Supreme Court had ruled that the Trump administration needed to facilitate his return. What is the latest on that case? Trump has been openly defying the Supreme Court, as have members of his administration. So what's going on with that case, and what's the hope that we can get Kilmer Abrego Garcia back into the United States to get the due process that he's owed under our Constitution?
Yeah, this is one of those situations where we had a case that was moving along really quickly. And this happens sometimes in immigration cases. there was this agreed upon motion after a hearing, like now, like 10 days ago, to basically stop stop everything that was going forward in the case publicly for a week. And we didn't know what that was. It was a closed hearing and there was no real explanation. And then earlier this week, on Wednesday, the Justice Department had asked for another week of delay, and that time the lawyers for Abrego Garcia did not agree to it, and Judge Zenas sided with Abrego Garcia's lawyers and set a rather aggressive schedule to go forward with these this discovery in the case, essentially trying to figure out and forcing the Trump administration to turn over information to Abrego Garcia's lawyers about what they actually have done in order for her to be able to make a decision about whether the Trump administration is violating her original injunction in the case. Now, I know you're listening to this and you're saying, well, obviously they did. We all know that. A lot of this is about Judge Zenas trying to make sure that there is a very clear record that the Justice Department, that DHS, that ICE, that the State Department, that everybody involved in this essentially has been given every opportunity to explain their actions before she makes any decisions about what she is going to do and what she is going to order them to do. And so we are slowly but surely moving toward that.
It seems like a pretty remarkable showdown in the works here, if we're not already in it. And this is a question from Janice in San Francisco, who writes, we keep hearing that we are in a constitutional crisis. Are we there yet, given that Trump's Justice Department is refusing to bring back Abrego Garcia? What is your take on this, Chris? I'm sure people are asking you all the time. I mean, are we there yet, or has the other shoe not quite dropped?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and actually I talked with a friend about needing to write something on this. So I'll tease it out a little here, and everybody should subscribe to Law Dork and you'll get it when I actually sit down and write it. But I think that the framing of are we in a constitutional crisis is ill-formed for a few reasons. I think that one of the main reasons is that I think it gives the administration an out at every point before we say that we're in a constitutional crisis. Doing things illegally depending on how you want to frame a constitutional crisis, that is a constitutional crisis. The expectation should be that the executive is seeking to act legally. And this administration does not appear to have that expectation for itself. And so, I mean, you could sort of start from day one in some of those January 20th executive orders and say that that's a constitutional crisis. But then you can also go, I think, dangerously in the other direction and say it's not a constitutional crisis until a court has held the Justice Department or somebody in the administration in contempt and they outright refuse to do anything about it, and we're a law-free society. Obviously, that's a little too late to say that that's your standard for a constitutional crisis. And so I think the answer is we're in a troubling constitutional period and have been since January 20th. And because the people who have constitutionally assigned roles are not acting in the way that they're supposed to. And that also goes back to what we started out by talking about with the legislative branch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a deliberate assault, a deliberate intention to break the law and dare the court to try to correct these illegal actions, potentially unconstitutional actions. And now we're waiting to see what's going to happen. I do want to read a quote from Politico from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. So in Politico, they write that Justice Jackson forcefully condemned attacks by President Donald Trump and his allies on judges who have blocked Trump administration policies, warning Thursday that the increasingly hostile rhetoric poses a dire threat to the country's political fabric. And Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson says the attacks are not random. They seem designed to intimidate those of us who serve in this critical capacity. The threats and harassment are attacks on our democracy, on our system of government, and they ultimately risk undermining our Constitution and the rule of law. And so my question to you, Chris, is do you get the sense that judges are couching their decisions because of this dynamic? Are they wary of cracking down too hard on what the Trump administration is doing because they don't want to precipitate outright defiance? Do you get that sense from the opinions that you've been monitoring that are coming out all over the country?
I'm sure there. I mean, like, let's keep in mind we have more than 90 district courts across the country, that some of which have like upwards of 15, 20 judges in them. We've got all of the 12 appeals courts across the country, and we've got the Supreme Court. So there's no one answer to how judges are responding. I think there are certainly some judges who are probably holding back. There are some judges who I think almost in their bones had either through their own experience working in the executive branch or their experience on the bench for a long time, who believed very strongly in deferring to the executive branch on many areas within their understanding, or even further than that, deferring to what they would refer to as the political branches, the executive and legislative, although I would argue all three of them are political in their way. But even some of those judges, I think, have learned over the course of the first 100 days, which, I mean, when we're talking about judges with decades of experience, that's the fact that that's all it took is itself notable, that this administration is different. And I think one of the key examples of that was Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, who is a judge on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And he is on the appeals court that has been hearing the Abrego-Garcia case. And the first time that went up to that appeals court, he agreed that Judge Zenas's order should be able to go in effect, but he wrote separately and said about his colleagues that they view this as an easy case. I think it's more complex. I think that these are difficult issues, et cetera, et cetera. Then it went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court issued its order with no dissent, saying that yes, they have to facilitate the return of Abrego-Garcia. And then the administration continued to push back. It went back up to the Fourth Circuit. And this time, Judge Wilkinson wrote the decision for the panel, and he said, sometimes it's difficult to get at the issues, not here. Mm-hmm. This is clearly an instance of the administration not understanding its role, not understanding mm-hmm. the court's role, and really issued a strong decision that harkened back to the Eisenhower enforcing Brown versus Board of Education, mm-hmm. and saying the executive has a a sworn responsibility not just to listen to court orders, but to wholeheartedly enforce them. And that is what our system is made of. So he was really making the same point that Justice Jackson was making.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have to hearken back then to that different time in our history of crisis with Brown versus Board. I want to let listeners know this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're speaking with Chris Geidner, journalist, MSNBC columnist with the Law Dork newsletter covering the Supreme Court, law, and politics. And we want to hear from you as well if you have questions about what's happening in the judicial branch right now with all of these various court cases challenging Trump administration policies. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. We have a caller, Aaron, dialing in from Oakland. Aaron, welcome to Your Call.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I appreciate Geithner's work on the newsletter and today's interview, and it's how I follow some of what's happening legally. I have no legal expertise, and I don't know if we're in some kind of, quote, constitutional crisis right now. But Baker's summary and the news seems to indicate that there kind of aren't any rules in effect right now to effectively govern the line between what is and isn't legal or allowed that the Trump administration is doing. And there's this question of when is the line too far? And the interviewee answered that one way of framing it is that, you know, makes the conclusion that it's too early to say. And the other way of framing it comes to the conclusion that it's still, that it could be too late already by the time we say it's, quote, a constitutional crisis. And I'm wanting experts and liberal news shows and media roundup tables to escalate that analysis in response to what's actually happening and kind of send the message to listeners, regular people, and organizers and whoever else is trying to make a decision about how to respond, that the time to wait and see and ask if things are really, really bad maybe is actually past, and to stop waiting to find out when it'll be too late, because that logic means it's always too early until it's too late. It's not about facts or legal questions. It's about the logic of what kind of political action could actually make a difference. And it's not time to wait. Now is the time to say everything that matters and holds things together is on the line, which we've been saying forever, but it's somehow still more urgent. It's not time to say maybe it's not urgent yet. Thank you.
Aaron, thank you for that, Aaron. I think it can be quite disempowering to tell people, well, let's just wait and see. Chris, what are your thoughts in response to Aaron's observation?
Yeah, no, I think that that's a very good point. And I think I would pair that with something that's sort of been my hobby horse over the past 102 days, which is that it is just as important while pushing back, while fighting illegal acts, to also sort of hold out the expectation of the administration that they have to follow court orders, that they have to do that. That so often whenever I post about an injunction or a temporary restraining order being issued, people's responses are, well, are they even going to follow it? And I think that that's such a dangerous way to respond, because that's just another way of giving them permission not to follow it. That the answer should be every injunction, every temporary restraining order that comes down from any judge, the expectation is they're going to follow it, because then that puts the onus on the Trump administration to justify any time in which they're going to try to, like, argue that they're narrowly interpreting an order or going all the way to outright refusing to follow it. And I think it's just, it's so important that we maintain just what is true, that if there is a properly appointed judge properly hearing a case who issues an order in accordance with court rules, that the way of dealing with not liking it is to appeal it, not to not follow it. And the truth is that we are seeing them following a lot of court orders across the country, that while there is this fight before Judge Boasberg about the two flights that they didn't turn around on March 15th, let's all remember that Alien Enemies Act proclamation based deportations did stop after that.
Yeah.
It was a victory. The courts did hold.
So it pushback did work in that case, and there was adherence to the decision. I think that's an important point. I want to read an email. We only have a few minutes left. There's so much more we can cover with you, Chris. But an email from Philip who writes, now the Trump administration has published a photo of Kilmer Abrego Garcia's hand with MS-13, the gang signed tattooed there. This has been alleged to be photoshopped. If so, isn't Trump in big trouble for falsifying evidence? Chris, quick thoughts in response to Philip's question.
I mean, it's hard for me to respond because it's the dumbest thing that's happened in this past 100 days. Like, it's literally a photo where they put the letters MS-13 above tattoos that people on the internet are claiming the tattoos below those numbers were originally MS-13 related tattoos. And like Trump appears to believe that like the actual MS-13 were the tattoos. I don't understand. And
but legally, are there any repercussions?
He's not falsifying evidence. Like he's giving a stupid interview. Yeah. Like that's not what DOJ is arguing in court.
Yeah.
It is misleading people. It's certainly dangerous. But I mean, it's no different than the 100 other lies that Trump shouts or posts on Truth Social every week.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. Jerry in Millbrae is dialing in. Jerry, welcome to your call.
Thank you very much. Surely there's a piece of paper, a contract, a memorandum of understanding between the United States and El Salvador about these people being sent and will pay you $6 million per day, per week, per month, whatever it is. That also says, and this is how we will resolve problems that arise between our two countries about these people about whom we have this contract. Has no one seen such document?
Wealth
of information.
That's been fought out. That's a very good question. That's come up in some of the what we have been able to see on the docket in Abrego Garcia's case. I suspect when it comes down to it that the administration is going to try to claim the state secrets privilege over that, which will lead to its own fight. It clearly is a relevant document. It clearly could directly answer the question as to how much authority we maintain over them. But I mean, like going back to your earlier question about the MS-13 tattoo, in the other direction, it is important when Trump makes statements against interest. In the legal world, if you make a public statement against interest, that can be relevant to your ongoing court proceedings. And Trump said that he could ask for Abrego Garcia to be brought back. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see that come up, and that might be a way of them saying clearly he was basing that on his knowledge of the underlying contract with El Salvador. And so therefore they can't claim state secrets privilege over that or whatever they're going to claim.
Yeah. Well, I do want to thank Jerry for that question. Just really about a minute left here, Chris. There's so much more I could be asking you about, but I just want to end by asking you, what are the Supreme Court cases that you're watching at this point? What's coming up next that we should all be tuned into?
I mean, the bottom line is is everything that we've been hearing this term. June is going to be the big month where we're going to find out where and how the court comes down on a bunch of key religion cases, including the case that they heard on Wednesday over the explicitly religious charter school that the Oklahoma Charter School Board is trying to approve, that the conservative Republican Attorney General is fighting over. But then we're also going to now have these arguments in May over the scope of the injunctions blocking Trump's birthright citizenship executive order. And so we'll be expecting that decision in June. Really going to be going through all of these cases that the justices have heard over criminal justice, over LGBTQ rights, the gender-affirming care ban in Tennessee. We still don't have a decision on that. That's going to be coming down in June, probably. All of these in June, and I'll be covering them at Law.org. I'll be going down to the Supreme Court, I'll probably be back with you guys at some point.
I was going to say, we're going to have you back on. June is definitely looking to be a very consequential month, and of course, a lot happening in the interim. So appreciate you coming on the show and explaining your thoughts, your observations about what's going on and giving us the details on these cases. That's Chris Geidner, journalist and MSNBC columnist with the Law Dork newsletter that I encourage all of you to subscribe to. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable.
Of course.
And I want to thank all of you, our listeners, for dialing in with your questions. That is our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit our Your Call page at kalw.org. And you can also follow us on social media and email your show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Tariq Ansari is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, and it's Your Call.